Media shouldn't be one note. Support Rabble.ca and a diversity of voices in Canadian media. Visit rabble.ca/donate to contribute.
You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. It is live on Friday, August 26th, and I'm your host, Darren Kaster, here in the studio. Stefan Hostetter is still on vacation, as is some of our other staff as well, which is why I'm again, and hopefully for the last time, teching my own show here at CIUT. So no Alex, no Stefan, but we do have some other good friends who've come back to join us, both of whom have been on the show before and will be assisting me through today's program. First up will be Paul Doerr, who's the author of The Walking Man and co-host of the Open Kwong Door podcast as well. Would you like to say hello, Paul?
Hello, Paul.
And then as well in the rest of the show is Atiyah Jafar, who is the who is a climate justice activist and also the digital organizer currently at 350.org. Welcome, Atiyah.
Hi.
So what we're going to be doing, we have sort of a somewhat orderly... Mm-hmm. Because Stefan's not here, so I'm like OCD. somewhat orderly traipse through the news cycle. So what we're going to start with a little bit is a little bit about one of my favorite companies to yell at, just because they're so despicable. And it's also a non-directly carbon-related story as well, which, you know, we got to take shots at somebody else once in a while. Mm-hmm. Paul's going to pick on Nestle a little bit, and we're going to start with sort of the general theme of water, and then Atiyah's going to talk to us about some North America-related sort of general pipeline and carbon-related stories as well. And then I'm going to be digging directly into, in the final area of the program, I'm going to be digging directly into the recently released and immediately set on fire by everyone BC Carbon Plan as well. And then I also have a very interesting story about somebody I have very mixed feelings about, which is somebody who's doing some interesting things in the oil patch, let's say in the technology sector. And the fact that I'm simply saying that I'm conflicted about it should interest you very much as well. But without any more teasing, I'm going to now hand us over to Paul, who will lead us in our first section.
Well, when I was looking at all of the articles that you sent us, I was thinking this one really sort of stood out to me, the one about water and the idea. Well, first, let's maybe talk about the article itself. It was from the National Post, everyone's favorite national newspaper. And the headline is Ottawa to renew permits for bottled water companies after outcry over costs. So you kind of go through the article, and a few things stood out for me. Is first of all, they're taking water out of the ground. And then they are putting it into bottles, and they're selling it to us. And they are paying $3.71 for every million liters that they take out.
Was that a million with an M, Paul?
Yes, that was million. I had to go back and look at that a few times because I thought 3.71 thousand something. I thought it was more than $3.71. Every million liters. Now, I had to look at this because I have to admit that I went down to the store and looked at the fridge and took out at a convenience store and took out a bottle of water because I couldn't remember. 500 milliliters is in a basically bottle of water. They're selling it for what? $1? $2? I'm terrible at math, so I'm not even going to try and figure that out. They're making a lot of money on this. And...
Well, we could round it to make it easy and say a million bottles at $1 is $1 million.
Yeah.
Right. So they're making $1 million at the cost of $3.71.
Right. So am I wrong to say that this is basically our water that they're repackaging and then selling back to us?
Not at all wrong.
Okay.
You're on point.
So then the interesting thing is they have all these permits with your friends from Nestle, for example. And they said, we want to try and phase these permits out. So my question was, what does that mean? Why can't they just say, no, we don't want to do this anymore? I don't know. I'm asking you guys.
I think the thing for me is that it's like one of those things where, you know, and I've done long, long rants about politicians before and where I think their heads are at when they do things. I took a right strip off Kathleen Wynne's back a few weeks ago, I think, for being a bit of a coward on a number of issues. But I think this is one of those things where, like, you know, after you're in office or after you're just like part of the political process, part of the political infrastructure, let's say, for long enough, you start. There seems to be this sort of, and you may actually have, you know, as a storyteller and having been involved with so many people's stories, this idea of the ability of people to sort of like disassociate from things. And I really just think they've disassociated from it because as far as they're concerned, I say, okay, well, we're not selling this water currently. So anything we sell it for is more money. And then I can use that money to prop up my budget and avoid having to make, you know, choices elsewhere. And I don't know. I think the sad thing is I think that's me cutting her the benefit of the doubt that they're just not thinking about it rather than just being either completely corrupt, completely evil, or a combination of the both. But what do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely sounds like pissing off Nestle is not something that they're very eager to do. I don't understand what the hesitation is either. And I think, yeah, definitely it's like these close ties that corporations have with our politicians. I think that's a really big part of it.
And do you also think that there is, on the political side of things, there's they don't come out and say it, but there is also that thing of, well, we, you know, it wasn't us that kind of did this. We'll deal with this, but like just kind of passing the buck again, you know?
Well, and it's one of those things where like it's the reason I both simultaneously wonder why, you know, our show wouldn't be picked up like something like the CBC, like, or not even me, like this isn't about me, but it's like the type of questions we ask on this program aren't asked of people. They're so simple, but I also know the answer at the same time. But it's just like, you know, it's not complicated. You don't even have to go on the offensive. You don't even have to do any research. Mm-hmm. Just at when the press person for the Ontario Liberal Party says, okay, we're doing this, you just take up your hand and say, you know, what is the benefit to the people of Ontario? Mm-hmm. I don't even think they could answer that question. I don't know what they would say. What is it? It's going to lower cost of water? No. Is this going to reduce our limited resource available for citizens? Yes. Is this allowing control of, is this more handing over of stuff that's public to private for the sake of profit that isn't going to go to Canadians? Yeah. I don't even know what the right wing argument for this would be other than, you know, beating of the chest and saying money, good, corporate, good.
Well, that's what I was thinking, is that why is there the assumption that something like water that in this case has been turned into a commodity, why is that just not even – that's not even what they're talking about. Like that's not the issue. Is it's just, well, I think even in the article they're talking about how, you know, Wynne and some of the other politicians are just – they're like, well, maybe they took a little too much, or maybe they're tight because it's been a dry summer. And I was like, what is like, there's no, I'm always looking at what is the larger discussion. And to me, the way that it was definitely presented in this article, there was no larger discussion about, you know, that is water a right, or should we have to pay for it, or should it be free?
Well, while you were talking there, Paul, I came up with the right wing argument against this, which I'm going to now use, which is, you know, we've been doing stories for the past like 2 years about massive water shortages in the United States. Ontario is blessed with a surprising quotient of the quote unquote renewable. That's obviously a complicated term in this case, but the renewable technically resource of clean, you know, fresh drinking water here in Ontario. We could make so much more money directly selling it to states that need water, which is something that's already happening and is going to increase happening at orders of magnitude, hundreds of times the price potentially, or maybe not, like maybe the same price, but like the same price would be like the moral argument, but guaranteed, if I'm going to stick with my attempt at a right-wing argument here, you could do it for more.
But isn't this dangerous to put the control of something like water into the hands of a corporation? Because what if something does happen in terms of renewable drinking sources And then we turn around and say, well, we don't want to do this anymore because we need to, you know, be more careful with this. And they just can shrug their shoulders and say the price is going to go up now because the need is higher.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's terrifying. And I think the commodification of water is something that there's a strong movement against that. Mm-hmm. And it's particularly strong in college campuses where now we're seeing different student groups pop up in campuses across the world that are saying, we don't want our campus to sell bottled water. Like mm-hmm. we should be, universities should be taking leadership and should be saying, no, we don't want to support these corporations that are actually basically just making money by commodifying a human right. That's mm-hmm. that's wrong inherently. And I went to school, I did my grad school in Guelph, which is just in southwestern Ontario. And Guelph is actually 10 minutes away from a Nestle bottling plant. And so literally the water that is in the fountains is the exact same as the Nestle bottles that are in the vending machines, right? And even at our campus, the group that was – there was a student referendum where students voted in favor of not selling bottled water on campus. And the university refused. They were just like, no, we're going to continue doing this. We have a contract that we've struck with Nestle. There's like definitely close ties between execs and Nestle and you know, board of directors at the school. And there's just strong resistance to phasing out the use of water bottles. And it's ridiculous. Like, I think the argument that has been presented by the university board is we want students to have options.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you mentioned the plant in Guelph, because then on the other side, so to me, this is another this could be a different kind of discussion. But I went through the article at the National Post and it said all these things about what we've been talking about. But didn't really, you know, go put off any alarms or anything. It just said this is a thing that is happening. Oh, by the way, but then I moved over to from the website Some of Us, where there's a petition, and they mentioned that 3.6 million liters per day from that plant near Guelph is being pulled out of the ground, and they're applying for a 10-year extension on this to just be able to keep doing what they're doing. And I just found it so interesting that when you moved over here, there was a little bit more of a, we really need to pay attention to this as a, you know, as a society, as people that are living here, that we need to, this is more important. This is not just a, you know, the National Post seemed to treat it as just, this is just a story. We'll put it over here. It's not really that big of a deal, but it really is. And I guess I'm just interested in how these things are portrayed. And then sort of slipping over into the idea of how we make people care about this stuff. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I'm a storyteller. I try and see how the narrative of all this stuff is being crafted all the time. And, I mean, this is water. Like, what do we have to do to make people kind of care about this and say, hey, we got to do something about this, or we got to say no to a corporation. Why is that a bad thing?
Well, and the whole economic argument for all this stuff, right, is that, you know, and this is what comes up in when we're talking about like oil and stuff like that, or any of these other, you know, products. They're like, well, okay, well, this is our economic system. If you don't like our product, you can choose a different product, except that this doesn't apply here. This doesn't apply. There is no other product. You require life. So this is a great time to stick in, of course, and I've said this repeatedly on the show before, but I'm actually prepared because I usually just say the CEO and I don't remember his name. I had a second to look it up today. So Nestle chairman Peter Brabeck, back in 2013, a position they've stuck to, by the way. This was not something that they like backpedaled 5 minutes after saying it because they realized how hideous it sounded. No, this is still their position. At least this is the chairman of the company's position, is that water is not a fundamental human right. Well, so you're literally, it's not an extension. It is directly equivalent to saying that life is not a right. Mm. That no one, if you can't afford to pay, you don't have a right to be alive. And this is, it's also tantamount to war profiteering, right? It's tantamount to selling arms to both sides of a conflict. Because and now that may seem like a bit of a stretch to some people, but think about it. The whole thing that you're doing, you're forcing someone into a position where they have to buy your product, and then increasing the price to a point, making such obscene profits, and that the obscene profits you're making directly contributes to the continuance of that problem, right? So the more water that Nestle buys up, the less there is that doesn't have to be paid for. And they're just buying out more and more and more and more control. And now you have no choice, right? Now, in this case, the war is the war to, you know, the war against your own death. But the metaphor holds. In fact, I'm not even sure it's much of a metaphor. We're just talking about a sort of simple, you know, find and replace of concepts. But it's pretty much direct. It's pretty much the same thing. Atiya, why don't we give you the last word on this, and we'll go to break in a minute.
Yeah. I mean, there's not much to say after that. Yeah. For me, it's just appalling that they stuck by that position. I thought that they retracted a little bit, or that he went on record being like, oh, I didn't mean to say that. This is what I meant. But the fact that the company and the individual have continued to be like, yes, water is not a human right, is just, it's appalling to me.
Yeah, well, it was sort of, it's like one of those tricky things where, like, he said he went back, but then rephrased it and basically said the same thing.
Basically,
so, I mean,
yeah.
They'll say that they stepped back from it, but what he stepped back from was the specific language used, not the position.
Right.
So, yeah, it's pretty terrifying.
Yeah.
So you're up next right after the break. Would you like to tease your segment here before we go to music break?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is a good segue. I'm also going to be talking about water issues, and particularly the ways in which water, and clean water in particular, is threatened by the oil industry, and how that disproportionately is affecting indigenous peoples across North America or Turtle Island. So first, talking about the Husky oil spill in Saskatchewan, and how it's particularly affecting a First Nations community that's just 300 kilometers away from where the oil spill happened. And next, I will be delving into the occupation, the blockade of the Dakota Access Pipeline that is happening right now just south in the United States, and how thousands of people are showing up in solidarity with the Lakota Sioux protesters.
All right, so all that and more coming up on The Green Majority right after this break. You're listening to The Green Majority Environment Radio Program here on CIUT 89.5 FM on our wonderful and very appreciated community radio partners all the way across the country and now into the United States and internationally as well. Our fabulous friends over at rabble.ca who also post the show and promote it for us as well. And of course, our podcast listeners. And if you're one of our podcast listeners, you also get to look forward to our bonus show after the air portion of the program. You can look for all that and more as well at greenmajority.ca. But now we're going to go to The Tragically Hip, New Orleans is Sinking. I couldn't resist. All right, we are back. You're listening to the Green Majority radio program here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Darren Kaster, here in studio as well with Paul Doerr and Atiya Jafar. And it is Atiya's turn to take the wheel, as it were. So why don't I just hand it right over to you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I wanted to start off by talking about the James Smith Cree Nation, which is nearly 300 kilometers away from the source of where the Husky Energy Pipeline spill happened on July 21st. It released up to 1,570 barrels, roughly 250,000 liters of crude oil and other toxins into the North Saskatchewan River. And First Nations, such as the James Smith Cree Nation, have noticed that it's been really, really impacting wildlife. It's completely changed the composition of the water near their community, and it's prompted an emergency with regards to the threat on drinking water in several municipalities, which means that there are strong restrictions on access to the water and drinking the water that's downstream of the spill. It's also killed more than 150 animals. And right now, federal and provincial authorities have launched an investigation. So the James Smith Cree Nation is a community. It's about 1,600 people. They're about 80 kilometers east of the province, east of Prince Albert. And they are definitely not impressed by Husky's response. And in particular, Husky Oil has hired in order to actually investigate the outcomes and the impact on drinking water. Husky has hired basically an environmental assessment company that has a really, really bad reputation. So this company is called the Center for Toxicology and Environmental Health, and they have a pretty bad reputation. They were hired by BP after the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill, after they were hired, the Times launched this piece on this particular company talking about how they had a really, really troubling pattern of repeatedly siding with industry and really underreporting the impacts of a particular environmental disaster. After Katrina, they were hired by a few industries as well to really assess the impact. And when they were hired by, I think it was an oil company, or they were basically investigating after Katrina the impacts on soil, and one of their employees was found on video smearing a soil sample against a pavement in order to dilute the toxins. So this was something that they were caught on video doing, and the Times is reported on it. And the leadership in this company is actually, when they were interviewed about this, they were like, oh, no, that article, it doesn't matter. It was a green article. Whatever that means.
It means the report was printed on recycled paper.
So we can't trust that.
Also, can I just, while I'm busy interrupting you, can I just point out the irony of like how dirty the sample has to be that wiping it on an asphalt surface is going to be is going to diffuse it?
It's ridiculous. So this is a company that is investigating the impacts on the water. So needless to say, communities like the James Smith Cree Nation are not impressed at all. So what's happening here? What are folks' thoughts?
Well, what's interesting is one of the things that we've been following on the program, obviously, we've been making a more of a concerted effort to, and it really has been made easy for us because it seems like a lot of sources, at least in Canada, are paying more attention to the issues of First Nations and Indigenous people. So we've been able to get more information, we've made a concerted effort to report on it more. And it's really, really interesting. Kind of it's done sort of a predictable thing, which is to bring out both the best in some people and the worst in some others, which is that for a lot of the sort of climate and environment minded folks that we're not already attuned to those particular issues, it has increased awareness. So I think there's been a net gain as far as the struggle to find the right word here that I'm thinking of, but the say the maybe political leverage with the public anyway, even if not the politicians of those issues. So that's good. And it has also brought out, you know, some pretty hideous people as well to come out and sort of be racist and say other horrible and terrible things. But I think the net gain here is that we are seeing a much increased coverage of these issues. So I have greater hope these days that this sort of outcry and these sorts of reports will stick, because it's just sort of in the news, and I hate that it has to be that way, but it is sort of just the reality of the situation. So I have a little bit of hope that this is that we're going to see increased redress of these issues, just because there's such a spotlight on it right now. And I hope that spotlight continues, obviously, but we can never be sure of that, right? The media and the public are fickle, so let's use the weight while we've got it. I don't know, what do you think, Paul?
Well, I was going to ask a stupid question, if that's okay.
Please.
This company, this assessment company that you were talking about, that sounds terrible, was hired. Is that – how does this work? Cannot politicians come in and say, well, we're going to bring in our own third party? Or like, where are they – who gets these people involved? Obviously, the industry does if they're going to be kind of saying – backing up, saying it's not the impact isn't that great, or whatever their result is, but who how do they come into play is I guess what I'm asking.
Yeah, that is a good question. So I think that when a company is so clearly responsible for the impact, they have to then take the responsibility for financing the cleanup, for financing the assessment process, to figure out how dirty is this water and how clean can we get it, and like what has been the impact of the cleanup efforts. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's Husky Oil that has the burden of doing all of that. And so they get to spend money on contracting a company to do that. And of course, they're going to hire the company that is underreporting impacts, that has, you know, like that has a reputation that is infamous for doing so. Mm-hmm. These issues are inaccessible for a reason. I think we're not there's a reason why it's so complicated, why it's so difficult for us to figure out what is the line of accountability. Mm. Where does the government step in? Are they doing an assessment as well? So from what I understand, there is a provincial and a federal investigation. I don't know if the province and the federal government are hiring different agencies to do the assessment, if they're hiring different companies. From my faith in the government of Saskatchewan, mm-hmm. I would say probably not. Mm-hmm. Federal government, I'm not so sure. But but apparently Husky is reporting that they've cleaned up roughly 47% of the shoreline. So are they making these judgments based on what this company that they've hired is telling them? Because if they're making that claim and the government is trusting them to make that claim, mm-hmm. since they're responsible for cleanup, I'm not sure how trustworthy that is.
Yeah. And a lot of the cases, I mean, this is an excellent way to answer your question with one of my favorite expressions, Paul, which is two words that are just beautiful together, which is plausible deniability. A lot of the ways when people say, well, you know, there's, you know, when we talk about, oh, there's loopholes, or we're going to get to the BC climate plan in a minute, which could be read with quite a heavy degree of naivete to be like, well, what's wrong here? It sounds like they're doing all sorts of neat stuff. Those are the types of loopholes that these companies make sure get into these agreements to cover their butts, and the politicians let them do it because a politician largely is concerned with the optics or how they can spin something rather than the reality, right? So they'll be like, okay, well, we're going to pass this really harsh, you know, thing where you guys have to do all this reporting and you have to do all this stuff. You have to do this, you have to do that. And the fine detail says, though, is that, you know, and they spin it as a positive. We're not going to charge the taxpayers for it. The companies will have to pay for it. Great. What that really means is the government is going to say, okay, you know, if you get caught and you get caught getting caught, then you're going to go do some research. You're going to send us a report, and then we're going to hold that report up to the press and say, here, look, we did our due diligence, blah, 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 blah. And what it does is it allows the companies to the degree of their morals, which I use very loosely, and their ability to fudge this information, and that allows the politicians cover to say, look, well, this is the report. You know, we don't know any better. They are the ones that did the report. And sort of everybody gets sort of like an easy pass. And unfortunately, that's all too often how it works. Everybody's just covering their butts.
Well, I don't want to think that there's a back room somewhere where people are all figuring this out. But when you went through all of the beats of this story, of the what happened, there was the spill, and then like all the effects that was happening, and then they hired this company, and then this is how it's going. It's so neat. What you're saying is there are these things in place that come into play when inevitably something like this happens, and why can't we change that?
Yeah. Well, and what happens is it sort of creates this. It creates this thing of making the person who's sane look like the crazy person, which is that after all of this gets reported, and you know, people like the National Post, who will report it, you know, as some drab, well, here's what happened because here's what the people we talked to said happened. It increasingly makes the, you know, when the company says something, the government backs them up and the mainstream media reports it, you know, something they've been a piece of paper they've been handed, and turn around and read it as if it's facts. Now you have a major corporation, a government, and the major news agencies saying that something, you know, the sky is green, and the environmentalists come out and say the sky is blue, and now they look like the crazy ones. And so everybody that wants to believe, to a certain degree, everybody wants to believe things and are very willing to deceive themselves to let it be true. And so all the people that, you know, don't want to have to, don't necessarily don't believe in climate change, but don't really want to have to do anything about it, or don't really want to have to change the rules because they kind of like the way they are, to say, okay, look, now you're just being crazy. Look, they did this. This is, what else do you want them to do? Right? You're being the extremist. You look at all this work we're doing, and it's never going to be good enough. And you guys are just crazy, so we could ignore you. And that's the reality.
And the thing is that they're not actually releasing their data publicly. So they're collecting data on the impacts of the spill, on how effective the cleanup has been. This data has not been released publicly. So there is not that kind of degree of accountability where people can't be like, okay, there was a spill. There is no possible way that we could have reached this level of cleanup in such a short amount of time. All that is happening is them saying, oh, we've cleaned up 47%. that's the number that they're giving. They're not actually telling us, okay, well, like, how do you actually, what was your method? How did you make that judgment? Yeah. And also what do you consider to be clean?
Yeah. Define clean is really important.
Yeah. what do you define? Will your CEO drink from this river? They're also, they're not mentioning the James Smith Cree Nation on their website at all. They're not actually recognizing the communities that have been impacted. But supposedly they are going to meet with the James Smith Cree Nation, and the federal, one representative from the federal government and one representative from the provincial government will meet with them as well. But yeah, like you said, it's a very perfectly packaged story. I guess with the oil industry, so when I was in grad school, one of the things that I was really interested in was this concept of agency capture. And that's the academic term used for when the agency that's meant to regulate a particular industry becomes captured by the industry itself. And so I was really interested in writing a paper on the impact of so basically agency capture with the oil industry. So how the oil industry has really captured the agencies responsible for regulating it. And when I was talking to my professor about it, pitching this, my professor turned to me and she was just like, you know, with the oil industry in Canada, I wonder if it's more a question of government capture. It's not just an agency that's been captured. It's not just the agency meant to regulate. It's not just Environment Canada or Natural Resources Canada. It's really the entire government and all facets of it have been captured by the industry that it's regulating. And I think I found that that really has resonated, where it's just like we allow them to get away with so much and more every time, even though we know what the trend is. We know that pipelines inevitably spill, we know that we cannot trust these companies to do the cleanup or to make statements about what a proper and effective cleanup process has been. Yeah, that's something to think about, and I think kind of like also relates to this conversation that we were having about Nestle as well, is like, why is the government so reluctant to step in? Like, we would think that these regulators would take more responsibility, that there would be more accountability.
All right. Well, we're nearly at the end of the segment. I want to at least let you at least introduce the Dakota thing. Just a really quick one on that, just to tie it up.
So speaking about oil spills, maybe taking like more of a preemptive approach, like the Lakota Sioux Nation, also known as the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. So basically, this has been going on for a couple of months, but over the last few weeks, this has really become something that's really picked up. So the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe has been suing federal regulators for approving the oil pipeline, the Dakota Access Pipeline, which is a $3.8 billion project. It would carry half a million barrels of crude oil daily from North Dakota's oil fields through South Dakota and Iowa to an existing pipeline in Patoka, Illinois. And right now what's happening is that First Nations from this nation are blocking the pipeline. So they've blockaded it. And recently they've had a victory where they've stopped construction on the pipeline. They've been taking action for a few months now, but over the last couple of weeks, thousands of people have joined them. At this point, it's 1,500 people are there. The construction on the pipeline has stopped. People are coming into this camp from all across the country, all across the United States. They're also coming in from Canada now. A number of other First Nations have shown solidarity and shown up. And there's also a lot of, settler allies that are there showing solidarity. So really showing us that that action can be taken to kind of prevent the disasters like the Husky oil spill from ever taking place. And direct action is getting us there. And also the leadership of First Nations that are defending their right to protect the land, their right to defend the water. So it's very inspiring work, and definitely sending a lot of love and solidarity to the people that are out there.
And it's an important to note as well, the Canadian angle here, which is that this is, and many people see this as simply the alternative to having, making up for the failed Keystone XL. It does involve Enbridge. Same company, different pipeline. It's only 7 kilometers shorter, or 7 miles shorter, whatever. For the scale we're talking about, that's an irrelevant difference. This is sort of what we're talking about. It's like, oh, okay, we know this huge fight. Obama says no. Okay, fine. We'll just call it something else and move it 3 miles east. It's the same fight. It's the same fight. And I'm sorry to say that I'm so much encouraged by all the by all the fighting that's happening locally, we aren't seeing the same sort of giant monumental tidal wave of resistance that we had to the Keystone XL. And I think that's because, you know, after Keystone got won, we've now, we, sort of the movement generally as this amorphous, complex, you know, non-single-natured thing, sort of have moved on to other things, not away from pipelines, but it's, there isn't the same level of resistance. And so I don't know what will ultimately happen. It could be possible that Obama steps in again. It could be possible a bunch of other things happen. Or this could be a news item for 36 hours. They arrest all the First Nations people and then, you know, this goes through. And I think we'll have to wait to see. So I agree with you that it's hopeful, but I have some reservations on my hope on this one, unfortunately.
Yeah, and we'll see how the lawsuit goes as well, because right now they are challenging the approval of this pipeline. So, and I think what they're saying is, well, we can't continue building it if there is a lawsuit right now that's challenging the approval in the first place. So that's an important point as well. So just want to end with talking about this really inspiring chant that I saw, because there's been a lot of great footage of this blockade. So if you get the chance, I would definitely recommend the footage that's up on Facebook. AJ Plus has been covering the Dakota Access Pipeline blockade. But the people there that were resisting were chanting, "We can't drink oil, keep it in the soil." And I think that's what it comes down to, is the water. And no matter how much money oil produces, in the end, we cannot drink it. And the most important commodity of all is the water and drinking water. So really, you know, I think as a society, we really need to be shaken up a little bit to recognize what is important.
Right. So, well, forgive the pun, everyone, but the show has probably one of the better flows than we've had in a while, because that also directly links into my story when we come back, which we'll be talking about BC's climate plan and the absolute sham that has become. However, we're going to go to yet another quick music break. This time it's going to be, and I did warn everybody, when I don't have other people here producing the music, we do have dance music. So we had Tragically Hip. We're going to now do a remix of Lana Del Rey for our second music break. We'll be back to talk about BC's carbon plan. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Darren Kaster, and we'll be right back. All right, we are back. You're listening to the Green Majority radio program, which you might, if you just tuned in, you may not have thought so, because we don't usually play dance music, but I'm in charge this week. Your host, Aaron Kaster, here, and also joined by Paul and Atia, who are going to now assist me in, I was going to say shredding the BC carbon plan, but that's already been thoroughly done by just about everybody. So I'm just going to inform you of other people's shredding. So this was a long overdue plan by the British Columbia government. Several months passed when they promised they would have something. Of course, BC was years ago heralded as one of the leaders on this, as some of the early adopters of many policies, including a provincial carbon tax, one that has been largely if you're talking politically, if you're talking voters, that sort of depends when you poll them on it. If you're talking to economists and climate folks, though, a very successful plan that is only weakened by its weakness. So there was due for some gear up. A number of recommendations have been had. Many big name and I would say very legitimate people, and though I've disagreed with Saporo Berman on a few issues over the years, she's definitely the real deal as far as she knows what she's talking about, and she's definitely, you know, definitely we're all on the same side. So I would I agree with her far more often than I disagree with her, and was one of the people that was now it appears after the fact window dressingly included in this advisory panel, because the advisory panel was essentially resolutely ignored. So and it was very strategic the way that they went about it. I wonder if maybe and maybe Atea, you have some insight on this, but I wonder if maybe they weren't sort of expecting to be so sort of thoroughly sort of flushed through, like so thoroughly, not torn apart, but like so thoroughly investigated, because, which I find very surprising, because A, it's 2016 and there's the internet, but also just with the number of people that really, really care about this issue, especially in BC, but in Canada in general, that it sort of feels like they didn't think they'd get caught to a degree, because what actually happened was they accepted. So there was I don't have the number in front of me. It's here. It's somewhere else in the article. I'll find it in a minute if I need it. But there was something like 27 or something recommendations, or 23 or 21 or something like that. And they essentially agreed to part of all of them. So if you're reading like the story in the National Post again, and we're just picking on the National Post today, you know, you could very easily write an article saying, wow, look at all the legendary stuff that they're doing. But they essentially, on every single one of the recommendations that they took away all of the meat of it so that basically none of them are meaningful. So what I'm going to start with, I have some more notes, and I'm going to transfer into some conversation about how this is actually on a different article from DeSmog blog. Right now I'm referring to a National Observer article, all of which, of course, is always listed on the website for your own reference, about how this is affecting the solar industry as well. But just to run through it, here's some of the planned changes. So developing a strategy to reduce methane emissions. So let me stop you right there. this culmination of our plan. So I have a paper due, Atiya, and the paper was due 2 months ago. And I handed it in 2 months late. And the opening section of my paper for my university class says, I'm going to create a plan for this paper.
Yep, that's basically it. We're not going to stop emissions. We're going to develop a plan.
Step one of my plan for becoming a millionaire is to develop a plan for becoming a millionaire.
That would have been a great commitment 30 years ago.
Yeah.
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 When we first found out about climate change.
Or like the day they said they'd come up with a plan.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's that. Reducing methane emissions, very important. So this you're already getting the sense of where this is going. You know, the thing that they imply that they would like to do maybe at some future point under very unspecific terms is a good thing. So a very, very naive reading of this would sound good. Second one on the list, introduce incentives to encourage companies to convert their vehicles to renewable natural gas. This is a theme we're going to hit on a few times, so I won't hammer on it too much now because I have several more opportunities in the list of 7 or 8 more things. But there's a theme here you'll see running where essentially what the BC government has decided that they're going to do is A, not meet their targets, but B, to the degree to which they are, is all about trying to influence consumers. So what they're saying was, as a government, all of the things that we have the most ability to do the most things, because we control the infrastructure, we control the taxes, we control all sorts of stuff. But we're not going to use any of those tools. What we're going to do is to influence the people with the most ability is the most portion of the problem. What we're going to do is we're going to put all the onus on individuals. So this is a theme you'll see running. So instead of instead of mandating that companies do this or that, or instead of putting, you know, strong financial incentives that are basically mandating, but it's sort of like, here's your path to adjusting with this, here's how you fit this into your business model, the type of regulations these companies have been asking for years so that they can deal with it. Stefan loves coming back to this thing about how coal companies were begging to be regulated because without regulation, they knew they'd just cease to exist. And that's exactly what happened in Ontario. So they were like, please regulate us so that we can work your regulations into our business model so that we can continue to exist. Mm-hmm. BC decided not to go this. We're going to ask them nicely to please eventually maybe someday convert their vehicles to renewable natural gas. There's the key phrase. Renewable natural gas. All right. Still climate change gas.
Natural gas is actually, in BC, it's been defined as clean energy by the government.
Which is important to note as we go forward here, because they like to use the word clean, and that's very important to keep that in. So now, thank you. Perfect. Number three, expand its clean energy vehicle program. Again, definition is very important here. What do you mean by clean? I might even ask you what you mean by vehicle at this point. I'm so skeptical of everything else you've written.
Yeah.
isn't that also kind of vague, that they're just going to expand it? What does that mean?
Larger than before. More than one. I think there's a little math symbol for that, right? Greater than one.
Right.
Great.
Or greater than zero might be more fair. So expand its clean energy vehicle program to encourage greater use of zero emission vehicles and increasing point of sale incentives for eligible vehicles. So once again, we're going to put the onus on individual consumers. Support more charging stations for electric vehicles and develop regulations so local governments can require that new buildings install adequate charging facilities. So great. I actually like this one. But when this is on your list of things you're going to do to solve a massive problem, you know, that's like telling me that this, you know, the steak I didn't order is going to have a really nice sauce on it. Love the sauce. I didn't order steak. Improve your transportation network through its BC On the Move program, a 10-year plan that includes increasing the number of BC transit buses that use compressed natural gas and expanding public transit to reduce congestion, particularly in Metro Vancouver. So, very big focus on vehicles, which again is a good thing if that was in addition to other really, really strong stuff. But not only is that insufficient, it also, by not doing these other things, by not having a stronger tax on carbon, you also neuter the effectiveness of all of these initiatives. So you're voluntarily shooting yourself in the foot. So we're almost done here. I'll just get through the last three, and then we'll sort of have a little discussion about this. So increased tree planting. So this is like my favorite headbang on the wall one, because that's like, we talk about low hanging fruit. That's the fruit that's been like rotting on the ground for 3 days. You haven't done that. That's part of your plan. And something I wondered, but I'm actually not researched enough to make a strong claim about, but I wonder as well, you know, because of course with the pine beetle problem, if that's not even a, like, pointless, like, are these, you know, pine beetle resistant trees? What's your plan for dealing? Like, is this a lasting thing? Have you calculated this? Based on the other thing, I'm really skeptical that anyone thought how to actually do any of this through, and if any of this means anything. Almost done here. Require all electricity acquired by BC Hydro to be renewable or clean. Coming right back to Atiyah again. What do you mean by clean? If you're switching everything to natural gas, better than coal. Sure, but we have other options, don't we?
Yeah, and natural gas also releases the most potent greenhouse gas, which is methane. So, I mean, it's not clean by a long shot. And I think the most important thing to recognize about the BC government is that they're a liberal government by name, but they are a conservative government in practice. They're the most right-wing government in BC's politics. So BC doesn't have an official conservative party. Their liberal party is their conservative party. And with certain policies, they're even more right wing of the Harper government. So I think like see this as a climate plan released by the Harper government. Like, they're not trying to impress anyone. They're not surprised that environmentalists like Sipora Berman are critiquing them. They didn't. Their intention with this plan was to just have something pretty, a report to point to. Action was never the objective, because if action was the objective, the BC government wouldn't be building a new fossil fuel industry from scratch, which is what they're doing with the LNG industry. They're building a new fossil fuel industry in BC for no reason. And that is an industry that we just cannot afford to build if we want to act on climate change, because climate change tells us that we should be keeping fossil fuels in the ground, phasing back the extraction projects that are already in place, not creating new ones. We shouldn't be expanding industries like the fracking industry in BC. So, yeah, it just very much does seem like it's all about you really need to know what they're talking about when they use certain words, because the words might sound pretty, but they don't actually translate to anything actionable, especially when the definition of clean is so distorted, when there are actually no targets for reducing emissions. There's only a desire to have a plan, a strategy moving forward.
Yeah, and this is where like the theme really starts to come in. I'll just shotgun the last two, and then we'll come back to sort of discussing them. But this is like really like my spidey sense started going bonkers after reading just this short list, because provide more incentives for marine vessels to be fueled with cleaner burning liquefied natural gas. So there's two things in there that got my attention. One of them was, okay, well, the marine vehicles you're concerned about are the tankers you want to move oil in. So not impressed.
Yeah.
that's like hiring vegans to operate your slaughterhouse. That's kind of doesn't really make any difference. I'm sure that makes great PR, but it's silly. It's actually just silly. And then introduce policies to encourage and develop the building the buildings that are carbon neutral. So a lot of emphasis on infrastructure, which is long term. A lot of emphasis on promoting natural gas, which if we assume that every time they say clean but not natural gas, we assume they mean natural gas. My immediate thing was like, who is in that government that's about to be or formerly from a natural gas company's board of directors? It just reeks of it. And so that's sort of one of the things that surprised me. So let's come back to sort of the environment reaction to this. As you said, you know, nobody's surprised. And I don't know if she was just doing it for effect. But the reason I'm not sure she was doing it for effect or if she was actually surprised was, you know, Sipora's tweet sent out a tweet storm right after, essentially after this got published. And she was furious and she sounded shocked. Now, I don't know if she was just phrasing it, if she was shocked for emphasis or if she was actually shocked. But one of the areas where I have disagreed with her in the past is that she seems far more not trusting, but like, I'm not sure I have a better word for it than trusting, but like she seems to think that if you ask them really, really nicely and keep repeating the same thing you've already said, that eventually these people will stop being greedy and not care about the climate. And so I'm assuming she's not actually surprised, but the fact that she seems surprised surprises me. Like, why even play it that way?
Yeah, I mean, it could definitely be, you know, the narrative, because often you know, we want to have the narrative of like, we don't want to come out and say that we're disappointed in the government before they've even done anything, because then that kind of turns a lot of people away. I think it's like sometimes more powerful to bring people there themselves to the point of disappointment. So to start off saying, well, we have hope that the government will do the right thing because they want to make a climate change plan, but get them, but like saying that it won't be effective before it's even announced is probably not the great way to actually bring more people on board. So getting people to a point where they're disappointed themselves and then expressing that disappointment with that large majority of people is one approach. But I think with Sipora Berman, her background is with the forestry movement. And she's quite famous for being part of this deal that was struck. I think this was with the Great Bear Rainforest. She was part of that deal that was struck between the government, the industry, and environmental groups, where they all reached an agreement about how to reduce deforestation, and it really just like placing really strong restrictions on how much of the Great Bear Rainforest in BC could experience deforestation. And so that was a landmark deal. And I think when you start off at that place, then you think that there's a lot of hope for agreements being struck between the government and industry.
But. All right. Well, I'm actually sorry. I was actually preparing to go to a further point, but I was having so much fun with that. We're actually out of time. So we'll have to carry this into the bonus show. I also, we didn't get to my my story about an oil company that actually has me feeling a little bit conflicted. That will be your tease for the bonus show. If you want to know the rest of our thoughts on this story and hear about this very confusing oil entrepreneur, you'll have to go to greenmajority.ca and download the podcast. But other than that, thank you so much for joining us. There'll be if you all want to shout out any web links or anything really quick before we go, that would be great. Other than that, thank you so much, Atiya and Paul.
No web links that I can think of right now.
350.org.
Yes, 350.org.
There you go.
/act.350.org/letter/stop-reject-kinder-morgan.
All right, I'll put that on the website for you.
Reject Kinder Morgan.
And your website, Paul.
Just go to pauldore.com. Everything's there. That's D-O-R-E.
Love it. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you so much for listening. We'll be right back with the bonus show if you're listening on the podcast. Otherwise, have a good green week, folks, and we'll see you all real soon.
Great. Thank you.